Welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in with me today is Preston Culver. He's an arborist, certified arborist, and he works with USU facilities. And we're going to talk a little bit about what to take care of around your yard before the winter sets in. And Preston, thanks for coming into the program.
It's my pleasure.
First thing would be, what is a certified arborist and why is that important?
Well, that's an outstanding question. A certified arborist is certified through our professional organization, the International Society of Arboriculture. And the requirements to sit for the exam are a four-year degree in the field or 4 years of experience working for a certified arborist. And so not just anybody can just sit down and take the test. And the test is quite rigorous. It covers multiple facets of tree care, from soil to biology, identification, planting, pruning, technical things. And so as a certified arborist, I am a tree expert. And as a tree expert, I mean, I can go on and on about trees with anybody. I like to. But as far as homeowners are concerned, a certified arborist is frequently willing to come and consult with you on your property for free. And they'll, you know, they're there ideally hoping to sell a job, but they can teach you about your trees. They can teach you about the soil in your area, about physiology and biology that's involved, and really give you a better picture of what's going on with your trees so that you can make better decisions.
So even before taking the test, you have to have either 4 years of experience working with a certified arborist or 4 years and a
horticulture
BA degree?
Horticulture degree
of some
something
kind.
Like that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you go out to someone's home, what are you usually going out there for?
Typically, if I worked for a tree care company, which I have in the past, you're going out there to talk about pruning their trees and shrubs. And so they are worried about the tree falling over. They're worried about its health or condition, that it's too crowded, the branches are scraping the roof line, something like that. And so you're just going to talk to them about, what can I do to fix this tree for you, or take it out, as the case may sometimes be.
But as you're saying, there's always so much more, and what you'd like people to know, it's more than just pruning the tree.
Yeah. We can advise you on where to put a tree if you're going to plant them, which trees to plant, how to take care of them and prevent disease. We can teach you. I like to teach people how to prune it. It doesn't behoove every certified arborist to go around teaching, because maybe they're going to lose some business there. But pruning correctly is not that difficult. There's a lot of experience that you learn, tricks and things like that. But basic pruning done right is quite simple. But it's just as easy to mess it up if you don't know what you're doing. And so as a certified arborist, it's extremely important to me to take as much time as I can to educate people about their trees so that they can do a better job themselves.
We've had Mike Coons, USU Extension Forestry Specialist, on the program quite a bit. And we've talked. I remember 15 years ago starting out the program and realizing, okay, I have a lot more to learn about how to prune a tree correctly, mm-hmm. because, you know, a shade tree is going to be different than your fruit tree. And even within fruit trees, everything's all different with that.
Yeah.
So beyond the fruiting part of the tree and learning how to prune the tree, mm-hmm. what do you like to teach your customers when you're going out and working with people?
I think tree selection is important. A lot of people want to plant a cottonwood or a poplar because they grow fast, or they want to put it right here next to the garage or next to the house or something like that. And if you're not thinking 20 years out, they say a poplar is a $3,030 tree. You buy it for $30, you plant it, and it grows like a weed, which is what you wanted. And 10, 20 years down the road, when it gets to be gigantic, you have to hire an arborist to come and take it out for you because you're afraid it'll fall on your house. Well, that's going to cost $3,000, and there's your $3,030 tree. So the value of an arborist then is helping to make decisions like that, and understand a little bit better what a cottonwood really means in the long run, not just, well, how fast does it grow, you know?
I know I've got a limb that two windstorms ago cracked, and I've got a fairly steep pitched roof, so I don't like going up there.
Yeah.
And so usually, though, I'll take care of those limbs if they're small enough. But this one's more like about a foot in diameter.
Okay.
So I know I'm going to have to bring someone in. So I already had someone do an estimate on it, and it's $500 just to do that one limb.
Wow. That's...
So it really can make a difference.
Yeah.
Knowing what to plant and when.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And situations like that, storm damage is actually extremely dangerous. A lot of homeowners will have their own chainsaw, and they'll try to clean things up. And when you get storm-damaged trees, sometimes the physics of the way they're twisted or bent or whatever is extremely unpredictable. And the experience of an arborist is to come in and try to approach that from an extremely safe position, an extremely safe work plan to avoid any accidents. And with the experience, then they can have a look at a situation and understand it much better than a homeowner typically can without that experience.
So let me back up and ask you, what is different between, I mean, we talked about the education, but why is it better to get a certified arborist to do a job than just someone who has a tree cutting service?
Awesome question. Thank you. Because you have to go through this professional organization, that creates standards. And the American National Standards Institute, ANSI, they maintain standards for tree care operations. A certified arborist should be committed to those standards and understand and know what they are. And so things like topping your trees, that's actually, in the ANSI standards, that's basically forbidden practice unless the situation is completely unmanageable any other way. And a certified arborist should ethically refuse to do any topping of trees, which is pretty common for people to want that. My tree's too big. Can you just... you know, take 30 feet off the top.
And it's the worst thing you can do to the tree. So.
Yeah, it's awful. And so a certified arborist is going to know, for starters, why that's bad. Second of all, they ought to have the professionalism to decline the job and or to, you know, educate the customer and say there's other ways we can deal with this without topping.
Now, I have my green ash where this limb has broken off of is a great case in point.
Yeah.
It's an older tree. I'm guessing it's probably 60, 70 years old, but it gives us shade. It's between the garage and the house.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody more than 20 years ago went up and topped the dumb thing. And so now I've got these weaker branches and they just get so big and the tree can't support them.
Exactly. Sometimes the trees will put the height right back, same year or the next. And those branches that it does put back after topping are always going to be weakly attached. Anything that grows fast is weak. And then they're more likely to break out again. You've got a huge wound that you made when you topped the tree, and that's going to start creating a hollow and allow for disease to enter the tree. It's a horrible thing, and a certified arborist is going to be able to help steer a customer away from that and say, you know, there's other ways to deal with the height of this tree without that dramatic topping. And so certified arborist versus just any old tree service, there's professionalism. They have to have a certain education and knowledge base, and that's something that is, in my opinion, invaluable. That professionalism is going to add safety on the job. When this limb that's cracked and over your roof, a certified arborist is going to be tested and tried on the proper techniques of removing that limb without endangering your roof, with completely mitigating the risk. Any old tree service, I don't know. Maybe he's going to try to do a swing cut, which is something that loggers will do. And it doesn't always go well. And the swing cut might not work well, and the branch ends up going through your roof anyway. And so it's all about professionalism and knowing what you're getting.
Well, let's dive into some of our fall topics of what do you do around the home to prepare the outdoors for winter. The first thing, again, when we're talking about trees, you're looking up to see, okay, what have I got that maybe I couldn't see because of all the leaves that probably should come out.
Yeah. So to start with trees, a lot of people are enthused about fall planting. And the first thing I will say is it's not wrong to plant in the fall, but you should do it with some care. with newly planted trees, one of the main or a leading cause of winter injury is lack of water from the fall planting. And so if you're going to plant a tree in the fall, be sure to make sure that you water it well. Next, as far as, you know, leaves have dropped, you can see the branches a lot better. Fall isn't the best time to prune because those leaves are dropping. And as the leaves are turning colors and preparing to fall, the tree is doing a lot of work to pull sugars out of those leaves and push them down into the trunk and into the roots where they're going to store them as an energy source to come back next spring. And because the trees are working so hard, it's stressful for them. And if you add pruning on top of that, you're just multiplying the stress. And so a lot of people will say, oh, I'm going to do some fall pruning. Well, I don't recommend that necessarily. The optimal time to prune is winter. January, February, March, I think, are the best time to prune any tree pretty well. There might be some exceptions there, but yeah. They're dormant. You can see the structure really well. And as soon as spring hits, the tree can respond to the wounds you've made immediately and with a lot of vigor, too. And so that really is ideal going into the winter to start looking at, what do I need to prune this winter? How many trees have I got? How much have I done previously? And it's really a great time for arborists because it's hard, sweaty work, and working in the wintertime sometimes can be a relief from the heat.
But would it be okay to take out like a limb like I've got or a dead limb? It sounds like
certainly.
You're not going to be doing much to the tree other than helping it out. So.
Yes, yes. Deadwood is always. If there's something that's dead or broken, go ahead and take it out any old time. Especially in a case of a broken limb, then there's a hazard. Don't mess around with that. Go ahead and take care of it as soon as possible.
Would your trees and shrubs be kind of like a rose bush? I know you're not supposed to prune rose bushes either until they're dormant. Otherwise, the rose bush has a tendency to want to put out new growth where it should be exactly the opposite.
Yeah, yeah. Roses are extremely vigorous, and so putting out that growth, you know, even late in the season is something that they'll do. Trees might not be quite that aggressive and assertive in putting on extra growth. It's just extra stress. They're in the middle of putting those sugars away for the winter, and pruning them hard in the fall or pruning them in the fall is really going to amplify that stress.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Preston Culver is a certified arborist and works with USU facilities. And if you have any questions or comments, post them to our Facebook page, the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. This is a recorded segment, but we will like to look at what you've got. And maybe you've got some pictures that we can post to our Facebook page as well. So you work here on campus. So what is your do you have a list of things that you usually go through? You're one of, I don't know how many arborists there are that work on campus, but a lot of people doing a lot of work.
We've got a number of landscapers, and I am the arborist. I'm the only one. And so I take responsibility for all 5,400 trees that we've got in our inventory. And I manage my schedule on my own for the most part. I'm fairly systematic about going through campus, looking at what has been done and what's needed, and trying to progress systematically from building to buildings, you know, area to area, making sure that all the trees are up to speed on all the pruning they need. As I do that, then I'll notice disease problems, I'll notice health issues, and sometimes that leads to cutting down a tree, or then of course planting. We actually have had a really heavy planting season this year. I was just thinking about it this afternoon. I may have planted 150 trees this year. I'm not sure.
How many did you have to take out?
Because
there are a lot of old trees on
campus.
Well,
yeah. As far as taking them out, it might have been a dozen or so. I'm not sure.
So what do you look for as you're walking around campus and looking at the trees? I know with USU's old, the quad area behind Old Main, that a lot of those maples are eventually going to be coming out in the next 10 years.
Yeah.
You've already got London Plains or sycamores, as a lot of people know them, planted around there starting to grow and get going. Yeah. What do you look for in a tree to know if it's reaching the end of its life or not?
Yeah, and that's a huge part of why hiring a certified arborist is valuable, because they have an eye trained to these kinds of things that might that just aren't obvious to the layperson. And so I'm on a big tree. I'm looking at old cuts that were made. And are they healing? I shouldn't say heal. Are they sealing over well with wound wood? Or are they staying wide open? That's a sign of health and vigor. You can look at how much it's growing. If you look down close at the twigs, you can kind of tell how many inches it's grown in this year versus last. You can look at the density of the canopy. Is it overgrown with lots of crossing branches and you know, is it kind of a thicket in there, or is it airy and open a little bit? The leaf density as well, not just the branch density, are the leaves sparse on there? And that's common on some of those trees on the quad that I've noticed, that the canopy is thinning a bit, and that's a sign of some stress and some decline in their health and vigor. And for a lot of other trees, young trees especially, I'm looking at their structure. I want to see what branches are there, and then I have to project my imagination 20 years in the future and ask myself, now if that branch is still there in 20 years and it's you know, a foot in diameter or whatever it is, how is that going to fare? Is that an ideal place for a branch, or, you know, do I need to go through and change the structure of this tree so that it can maximize itself throughout its lifetime?
And each tree, of course, has a different growth pattern, yep. How fast it grows or yep. Slow it grows. And are you on the just say no to Norway maples camp, or where do you stand on that?
Well, I find that I go back and forth on a lot of trees.
I'm not seeing a lot of them planted anymore,
yeah.
Let's put it that way.
And Norway maples is one that is, it's easy to understand why it's a favorite tree and why it gets picked so often. But at the same time, I think with some research, with some forethought, and you can usually find a tree that will suit your needs better than a Norway maple. So not my favorite tree. They're fraught with issues that I think are best avoided.
Well, and I think we're seeing that on the quad right now at Utah State,
yeah.
Where they are now.
Yeah, those are about 85 years old, and there are some of them that are getting to be dangerous. And there's what can be done but to take them down, unfortunately.
Well, and the hard part, that I'm sure you've seen this, is a lot of people, when they see a big tree being taken down, they don't understand everything that's behind it. All they see is,
yeah.
Oh, here's this empty space. Why did they chop that down?
Yeah, and the quad certainly is. That's an icon.
Or Old Main Hill would
yeah.
be another one.
And we hate to see those trees go, but safety is the issue at hand here. And the trouble with that is we can't really predict which branch would break when. You know, is there going to be a blizzard tomorrow? Well, the weatherman can tell you about that, but we don't know if there's going to be a blizzard in a month or two that will dump 18 inches, and all of a sudden you've got all of this snow load on a branch that might break it. And how big is that branch, and which branch will it be on the 50 different trees that are around the quad? Which one is going to break? And so there's all this risk involved. Well, then we have to make some careful decisions. How do we manage the risk? What's the safest way to do it? Well, what's the most pragmatic way to do it? You know, and there's different perspectives, and we have to approach the matter sensibly and carefully to make sure that we take care of the campus community so that nobody gets hurt.
You've got to have your favorite trees. I want to hear, what are your
Certainly.
Favorite trees on campus?
Oh, on Old Main Hill, down towards the southern end, there's a couple of rows of trees that are kind of lined up like. And there's a couple of pines in there, but the bulk of the row is some sycamore maples. And one of those sycamore maples is the state champion. It's the largest sycamore maple in the state.
What is a sycamore maple? I mean, is it just a cross between the two?
No, it's just named after the sycamore.
Okay.
The leaves are similar, and it gets a little bit of an interesting pattern on the bark, similar to what a sycamore would have. And it's an uncommon tree. Hardly anybody plants them. And I think, man, we ought to be planting this one instead of the Norway maple. And it's just a nice shade tree. I really like that one. At the biology building, it's kind of horseshoe shaped, and they're in the courtyard area, kind of, I think of it as behind the building. There's an English oak in there, and I can't remember. I think it's about 24 years old when I looked at the records, and it's tall and it's straight, and oak trees just thrill me because to me that's almost like the icon of longevity and strength as far as trees go. And I'm so excited about that tree, and I think, boy, this building might get torn down before too long. I don't know, and I sure hope this tree survives, you know?
Do you have any say in it's like, you know, we really should keep this tree here. Please try to work around it.
I hope so. I mean, planning and design is a different department than landscape, and there's lots of different factors that come into play there. Timetables that are sometimes years out in the planning process, and then there's budgeting that factors into that. And so in some cases, yes, they'll ask me to consult on a tree, but probably not as often as I would prefer. And of course, you know, from my perspective, that's that's understandable that I would prefer to be involved a little bit more. But sometimes trees get taken down and it hurts me. And I think, boy, why did they have to do that? It wasn't right next to the building. It was, you know, we could have saved that one or something, but so it is. I save them when I can, and accept the fact that in a city, in an urban environment, trees don't have as long a lifespan, and a lot of it has to do with development, progress, change.
Now, is there a giant sequoia on campus?
Yeah, we've got giant sequoia.
Which is really interesting for me, because I was just in Northern California and seeing these things. I know they'll never get that big here, but...
Yeah, we've got giant sequoia. They're not so giant right now. There's a few on Old Main Hill, and I actually planted one last year right when I took the job. It's on the west side of Rayview West. There's a small lawn area there where the streets kind of intersect, and it's only about 6 feet tall, this little spire. It's actually a weeping giant sequoia, and it's exciting to plant that tree and think of the potential there, you know. I don't think it'll ever get that big, but it's exciting to think of it.
And then I've seen bald cypress, which a lot of people don't know are not just in the swamps of Louisiana, that they'll also grow in Utah soils.
For the most part, the bald cypress we have are kind of scattered around, some of them in more obscure places, but the one that is our biggest is in the lawn area that was previously where the Ag Science Building was. And that was one that we definitely made a move to make sure it got preserved in the demolition of that building. It's really a fine specimen.
Is there a small bald cypress over here by the halls? So right on the corner?
Bullen Hall.
That's oh, okay. I've wondered. I've walked by there as I've gone to my son's class.
No, I take that back. I believe that's Don Redwood. The two look very similar, and they both drop their needles in the fall.
Yeah, it definitely drops its needles.
And, boy, now you got me doubting. I'm not sure.
It's not like you have every single tree on campus, or maybe you do.
Yeah. Well,
in time,
yeah.
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 Any recommendations you would give for a homeowner? What would you suggest for someone who isn't worried about something that's fast-growing but just wants to have – something different? For instance, I was looking through a catalog, Forest Farms out of Southern Oregon, and in consultation with Mike Coons, and just looking for something different that everyone else in the neighborhood had. So I planted a Himalayan white pine.
Oh,
love it. And I first saw it over by the alumni house.
Yeah.
There's one that's growing there.
Outstanding choice.
Long needles. It just looks, it's now about 15 feet tall.
Yeah.
And each year it grows about another foot is about what I get out of it.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Great tree. The sycamore maple, they have one that has a two-colored leaf where the top side is one color and the bottom side is another, and it's purple with green, and it's really striking. So that's sycamore maple, and I think you can find that one at Tri-Cities Nursery down there in the Ogden area. Another one would be Zelkova, and that's a relative of the elm tree. And the Zelkova is really neat because it's fairly drought tolerant, and it's very free of disease, relatively free of disease. It also comes in a couple of different forms. There's broader forms where that spread a little bit wider, but they also come with some that are fairly narrow and upright. And so in my perspective, the Zelkova fits a lot of homeowner spaces where it's not a gigantic tree, but it's also going to be quite sizable, has some flexibility in what shape you get, depending on the variety, and can really fill in a landscape beautifully. They're also one of the few trees that gets kind of an orange, rusty orange color in the fall here in Utah. That's not so common.
What about shrubs? What would you recommend for shrubs?
Ooh.
I know there's pistachios on campus, but I'm not divulging where I know they are.
Yeah, and those pistachios are an anomaly for sure. They don't belong in Utah. Well, I shouldn't say Utah at all. Southern Utah would be fine, but they don't belong in northern Utah. As far as shrubs go, well,
seems like everyone, they do the burning bush thing,
yeah,
and I kind of like,
bush,
everybody's growing those. I want
attractive.
Something different.
Oh, boy. Maybe you stumped me.
Or as a hedge, maybe? What would you do as a hedge?
I like yew. It's got a nice, solid, dark green and a good texture, too. You know, everybody knows juniper, and sprucey has such the dense, thick, and, you know, when you touch it, pokey texture. But the yew is much softer and more feathery. And so, you know, a hedge out of yew, I think, is really attractive.
Now, do deer like yew?
Yes, they do.
My dad had one, so it's like I had to ask.
Yeah.
So and would you have to, like, wrap it in the winter to keep, if you've got deer around your house?
Well, you know, deer are a nuisance for sure. And as far as I know, the best way to keep deer off of your plants is a good dog.
Okay.
Yeah. Other than that, you know, mixed results.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. We're going to take a break here for just a little bit, and then we'll be back with Preston Culver. He's a certified arborist with USU Facilities. So stay tuned for the rest of the hour.
Carving pumpkins is a fun Halloween tradition, but don't let those pumpkin seeds go to waste. Try roasting them into a healthful snack for you and your family to enjoy. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Start by removing the stringy pulp from the seeds. Rinse the seeds with cold water and pick off the remaining pulp. Spread the seeds in a single layer on a baking sheet coated with a nonstick cooking oil. Or use vegetable oil and stir to coat the seeds. Next, lightly salt and bake at 325 degrees for about 25 minutes or until the seeds are toasted. Stir the seeds after 10 minutes and allow to cool. Change up the recipe for a bit of extra flavor. Roast 4 cups of pumpkin seeds as above, but this time season with 1 teaspoon salt and 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon. Store any leftovers, if there are any, in an airtight container. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Stokes Nature Center's 16th annual fundraiser, Van Gogh Going Gone, with seated banquet, beverages, silent, and live auctions. Saturday, November 2nd at 6 p.m. at the Copper Mill in Logan. Information at logannature.org. Support also comes from Green Valley Spa and Resort in St. George, offering a poetry salon the fourth Thursday of every month, featuring booked poets, singers, and songwriters. Details at greenvalleyspa.com.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Preston Culver, certified arborist with USU Facilities. And Preston, in the open to the program, I promised that we would talk about some things to do around the home to prepare for the winter for outside. Yeah. And one of the things that we just mentioned before the break of the program was, do you have to wrap a yew tree? So let's talk about tree wraps. Do you have to wrap trees? I know fruit trees, younger fruit trees, I have to put on a white, the plastic wrap that I get. Uh-huh. Otherwise, especially with my cherries, I end up with splitting bark and then end up having to chop them down.
This is a great topic. a lot of the evergreens, you get a snow load, and then the limbs will spread out and sometimes break, or just, you know, it'll be deformed if you leave it like that. And so just wrapping a tree with a burlap strip will help avoid that. Now's a pretty good time of year to be out there if you don't want to be out there in December, January, when it's already freezing and have to knock the snow off before you wrap it. You don't want to leave the wrap on there forever, of course. Make sure it gets off in the springtime when the danger of snow is going away.
So it could, as the tree grows, girdle the tree itself?
Well, yeah, and just compacting the... If you're compacting the canopy at all, it's going to start suffering from lack of air movement and light filtering through and getting through the canopy well. Wrapping trunks and painting them white is something that a lot of people have asked about.
Just with latex, white latex paint?
Yeah, and I actually started looking into it because I've heard mixed.
They do it with citrus trees in Arizona all the time.
Yeah, so I've heard mixed results on painting or wrapping tree trunks, especially fruit tree trunks. So the issue at hand there is frost cracking in the trunk, sun scalding, it's also called, when temperatures are swinging through the wintertime, or especially in the late fall, early spring, when you might have a day that's quite warm and sunny, and then as soon as the sun goes down, the temperature will plummet. And if you've got sap in there, it can start shattering cells as that refreezes at night, and you end up with some serious wounds on some trees. It'll kill them. And so people will put some kind of a wrapping on there, either a cloth wrap, some of them they're little plastic shields, and the idea is that that's going to reflect light and prevent that from happening. Or painting them white, like we said, with latex paint. And so I've looked into the scientific research on this, and from what I have found, it is kind of a mixed bag. It's hard to know.
Of both or just the paint?
Of both, yeah, whether it's doing any good or whether it's actually causing harm. And so if you're putting whether it's the cloth or the plastic shield, part of the worry there is then it also becomes an insulator. And so if you leave that on, if you put it on too early in the fall or leave it on too late in the spring, then you might actually start exacerbating the problem where it's getting extra warm in the daytime, and then come nighttime it'll freeze again.
So maybe making sure that that's only on for, say, the end of December, January, and the first part of February when it's the coldest?
I don't know what conclusion to draw, honestly. I don't know what to say. If you found something that you feel is working, go for it. I know somebody has told me that the arborist there in Smithfield, he has had success with some plastic shielding that he's been putting around the trees, enough so that when it was relayed to me that I was buying it. I was willing to look into that, and I haven't had a chance to follow up on it, but it's something, you know, that where anecdotal evidence sometimes is enough to sell us on something, right?
I know with my stone fruits, because stone fruits are always somewhat marginal in the Cache Valley anyway, that with my cherries, for instance, my sweet cherries, if I don't have something on the bark, I invariably, it starts to split, and then I get pathogens that get in, and I don't know if it was a canker I had in there, but it seems like I can't keep a sweet cherry longer than about 3 or 4 years, and I'm having to cut it down and replant.
Sure, yeah. And that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's the worry. And if you're having success with shielding it with the plastic, I think that's just fine.
Okay. Well, let's move on to as far as perennials. It's a little bit late now to divide perennials, but I guess if you wanted to, you could not replant them if you wanted to, but just
cut them down
a little bit.
Yeah, and so, you know, ornamental grasses, or whether it's your daisies or your black-eyed Susans, daylilies and whatnot, now's a good time of year to go through with either a weed whacker. It does a not so pretty job, but it's fast, or a pair of shears and chop them down, not all the way to the ground, but, you know, leave 2 inches, 4 inches, depending on the type of plant, exposed. Get rid of the, you know, all that's just going to die throughout the winter one way or another anyway, And so get rid of it now. There's, you know, still warm days where we can be out working and getting ready for spring, even though it's, you know, 5-6 months away.
Are there, as far as the perennials are concerned, do you have to cut all the dead out? My wife was asking me this the other day, and I usually like to leave them until they've gone completely dry because the plant is still pulling nutrients back into the soil.
That's a fair argument. Nothing wrong with leaving it until later.
Are there some that we really shouldn't cut back at all?
As far as perennials go, I would say no. Go ahead and cut them back.
Okay.
That's what they're designed to do. It, you know, in nature, the dead stuff just stays there. We haul it off because it looks better. If it's a woody plant, though, cutting it to the ground, that's a different story. You know, with your roses or your shrubs and whatever else.
I've got a butterfly bush, the last one of about four I planted. I just cannot keep a butterfly bush in my house, outside my house in Hyde Park. But I've seen other places that mine will usually die all the way back to the ground and then come back out again. So I never get a large shrub those that maybe are up on the bench or up against the house where they've got heat coming off
little
of the brick or something. They're rather large. I get kind of jealous because I really like butterfly bushes. But can you insulate a little bit?
Okay.
A shrub, a smaller shrub to help it through?
That's an interesting question. I have a Japanese maple in my yard. And last year when we got our first good snow, I was sure to pile it up around there. And this is theoretical. I don't know if I'm right about this, but the idea is
makes
that
you feel better
I'm
anyway.
Insulating it.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
And I think there's something to it. In theory, it does make sense to me that that's going to work. It's not just that I came up with this idea that I think is going to be great and fooling myself.
So what typical plants would people have around here that should be mulched a little bit to protect them?
Mulch is another great idea with perennials or something that you're going to cut back lower to the ground. Putting mulch there can definitely help insulate them.
Roses is the big one that comes to mind. My mother will put cages around, put leaves around those.
Yeah. There's probably a number of them, and I'm having a hard time coming up with anything off the top of my head.
With relation to what you do here on campus, do you aerate your lawns?
Or
does it just depend on if they're high traffic areas?
On campus as needed. Athletic fields, of course, get it all the time. High traffic areas, it makes really good sense to get in there and aerate regularly. Aerating your lawn, do you need to do it every year? Maybe not, but I think it's a good idea. That it's not just something that we do because we do it. There's a science to it, and aerating your lawn makes sense. I think aerating your lawn is probably going to do a lot of good for your trees in addition to your lawn. That's something that a lot of people would probably overlook.
How is it good for the trees? I'm thinking, well, it's going to allow nutrients and water to penetrate maybe past the lawn point a little bit better, at least for a while.
It's the same issue. All roots need some air, and so you're aerating to help the air get down there. It helps with water penetration. Sometimes you'll get a layer of clay or something that builds up, and sometimes that'll be coming through in your irrigation water. And it's just tiny amounts, but over time that builds up and you start to get a layer of clay. And that clay can be really difficult sometimes for water to penetrate. And so aerating creates those natural creates an openings that aren't natural, really, so that it can naturally break up those layers as it freezes and thaws throughout the winter. And things are going to be looser. Things are going to allow water to soak in and penetrate a lot better when you're watering next year. And there's better air, nutrient, the whole thing. It's an excellent idea.
Should you fertilize, we've already talked about not pruning in the fall. Should you do any fertilization in the fall?
Now, this is something that I have my basic knowledge on, but I called a friend of mine. Jim Gish is the pesticide expert at BYU. And I called him this afternoon to get his final word on the matter, because I had my thoughts, but I wanted to know what he said. And he says if homeowners were going to invest in fertilizer just once throughout the entire year, now is the time to do it.
And this is just for the lawn, or is this for everything?
For the lawn.
Okay.
Trees, I don't often recommend fertilization of trees unless it's clearly needed for some obvious deficiency. Other plants, you know, your garden, your roses, tomatoes, things like that, that's more of a summer thing where they're in their growing season. But for your lawn, if you're going to do just one fertilizer application, now is the time to do it. And more specifically than that, the nitrogen is the most important. The phosphorus is more negligible as far as lawn applications go. And the potassium is helpful, but not as crucial as the nitrogen. And so you want to the timing on that is crucial, because if it's still growing and you put the fertilizer on, it's just going to push it to grow more, and that's not going to be helpful. And if it's already fully dormant, likewise, it's just going to sit there and do nothing, or wash through the soil even, and do you no good at all. So you want to monitor your lawn. It'll almost stop growing, you know, at the end of the season. Maybe in September you mowed three times, and in October you mow once or something like that. And so you want the grass to be, it's shutting down that top growth, but it hasn't gone fully dormant yet. It's not turning brown. And I definitely noticed this in my lawn in these last few weeks. And in fact, we may be right where it's getting to be too late. If your lawn's turning brown and going dormant, we might be a little
too late. I wondered, because I looked at ours and we did make a mowing. Yeah. It's hardly grown any. So
yeah.
Now as far as the fertilizer, you're looking at a nitrogen fertilizer, uh-huh, and a quick release so that the plant can pull
it
up?
Yes, and that's the idea. A lot of people would put down the slow release. It'll be there in the spring, and that's not necessary at all.
It just leaches through.
Just regular old nitrogen.
Okay.
And what happens then is if the top growth is stopped and it's taking on the nitrogen, it's putting that into root growth and strength for the spring. And that's what Jim said is going to be the most important fertilization that you put down in the whole year.
Well, we've reached the end of our time. Preston
right.
Culver is a certified arborist with USU Facilities, and he's been in with us today talking about how to prepare our yards for the winter. Preston, thanks for coming in.
It's been my pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. We'll now hear a little bit from Nancy Williams and her Petals and Pros segment and about spiders.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams for Petals and Pros. And because we're approaching Halloween, I thought it would be really cool to read you an interesting essay about spiders, which are kind of Halloween-y. This is from one of my favorite books, Sue Hubbell's A Country Year, Living the Questions. And I love spiders, and so this works. I really do. I have to confess. I think they're fascinating. I don't like them if they bite me, but most of them won't bite you. And this has to do with some of the most fascinating ones that we have and that people actually ask me about once in a while. This is what Sue has to say about spiders. There is a magnificent dappled brown and gold house spider changing her skin today in a corner up above the wood stove. A spider grows by molting its skin, which doubles as a skeleton. My spider spent yesterday quietly in her corner getting it all together and feeling a bit uncomfortable, I suppose, for I read that spiders raise their blood pressure in molt. It has taken her the best part of the morning to crawl out of her old skin, and now she is hanging beside it, resting from the effort, which must have been considerable. Her old skin is beginning to shrivel. It looks wispy and impossibly small for this fine new spider to have worn. She is big, more than half an inch, but not as large as a similar house spider I have seen in the kitchen, so she probably has more molts to go before she reaches her full size. Molting is one answer to the problem posed by growth. Not mine, to be sure, but no less correct an answer for all that. Biologists like to emphasize that growth from the inside out is one of the characteristics that separates things that are alive from those that are not. Crystals, which are not alive, grow, but they do so by accretion, simply adding new material to what is already there. Human beings and other mammals who hang their soft body parts onto and outside a skeleton never have to face the growth problems of creatures such as insects, grasshoppers, or the honeybees out in my beehives, or spiders, which are not insects at all, but arachnids. Growth does present certain difficulties, but they are different ones. Spiders, grasshoppers, and honeybees, or lobsters for that matter, wear their skeleton on the outside, and so when they grow too tight, they must find some means to shed them. Many insects follow molts with metamorphosis, a complete and radical dissolution of the old body form and rearrangement into a new one. But spiders just step out of their skeletons, doing so anywhere from 2 to 20 times before they're grown, but keeping the same relative form. Baby spiders, unlike many baby insects, look like the adults, but smaller. One night, when I turned on a light in my cabin, I found a mother wolf spider with her back covered with babies. Most spiders don't have much interest in their young, but wolf spiders carry them around wherever they go. When the spiderlings emerge from their egg sac, they crawl up on the mother's back and cling to her. The ones I watched, tiny, delicate, perfect miniatures, were an unruly lot and appeared to be causing her no end of trouble. They crawled over her eyes and she had to brush them away. They jostled one another and several tumbled off onto the floor and then scurried to climb up her legs and return to the security of her back. The wolf spider and the house spider are both big, as spiders go. An outside skeleton imposes mechanical limits on the size of a body that can function nicely. But other, even larger spiders are common in my garden. The black and yellow argiopes, which spin distinctive webs that look as if they had zippers in them. They are brilliant, glossy, stylish spiders, and out there in the garden they trap grasshoppers that eat my tomatoes. They spin winding sheets around the insects and store them until they're needed, like thrifty housewives stocking the larder. It's a way of making a living, of which I thoroughly approve, the sort of thing that makes us label the spider as beneficial while condemning the grasshopper as harmful. I'll admit that I wasn't nearly so pleased one day when I discovered a black and yellow argiope who had spun her web in front of one of my beehives and had stocked her particular larder with tidily wrapped honeybees who had flown directly into it on their way home, heavily laden with their loads of nectar. I destroyed her web and moved her over to a bush where I hoped she would find something to eat that pleased her equally and me rather more. Web-weaving spiders don't see very well by our standards. They are so nearsighted that when the males come courting, they pluck the strands of the female's web to announce their arrival in order not to be taken for tasty morsels. So I doubt that the beehive argiope was able to see me when I moved her. In a way, that was a pity, because for all of our differences, we share something important. We are both beekeepers. Both of us make a living from the bees. My way, compared to hers, seems excessively Byzantine. I cosset the bees all year long, take away their extra honey, process it, bottle it, truck it to New York to sell to Bloomingdale's, and then use the check to buy things I need. She simply eats bees. We are both animate bundles of the chemicals common to all living things. Carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur, and phosphorus. Both of us have been presented with a set of problems posed by our chemistry and quickness. Among them, how to grow and how to make a living. Those are big questions. And as often the case with big questions, we have come up with different answers. Answers that in turn are still different from those of the honeybee, who is a similar chemical bundle and upon whom we both depend for a living. The honeybee's solutions have more to do with metamorphosis and the nectar of flowers, and those answers are good ones too. Living in a world where the answers to questions can be so many and so good is what gets me out of bed and into my boots every morning. This, again, is from Sue Hubble's book, A Country Year, Living the Questions. I thought, since this is sort of a spiders and Halloween piece to read to you today, that the best recipe that I could give you would be for candy. This is much better than that store-bought Halloween candy. You probably couldn't give it to your trick-or-treaters, but you could give it to you, and you could have it at your Halloween party. And in celebration of Sue Hubble's bees and mine, it is a recipe for honey milk chocolate fudge. So good, so easy. Here we go. It yields a little over 2 pounds. You need 18 ounces of semi-sweet chocolate and 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1.5 teaspoons of honey, 1 1/3 cups of condensed milk, that is a 15-ounce can, and 1/2 cup of coarsely chopped nut meats. You butter or line an 8-inch square pan or the equivalent with wax paper or foil. I always just butter the pan. Melt the chocolate in the top of a double boiler over hot water. Stir and remove from the heat when melted. Add the salt, honey, and condensed milk. Stir it up to make a smooth mixture. If you like, add the nuts. Pour the fudge into the prepared pan. Spread it evenly in the pan. Smooth out the top. If you like, decorate it with more nuts, either crunched up nuts in little tiny pieces or half a walnut. Put them 1/2 inch apart. Refrigerate it for at least 2 hours, cut into squares. Keep refrigerated, but remove from refrigeration about 20 minutes before you want to serve it. That is like the easiest fudge recipe in the world. Even your 5-year-old can make it if you stand there and watch them. Enjoy it, and you can find this recipe on the UPR website, upr.org, under the Zesty Garden. See you next time.
Nancy Williams is a journalism professor at Utah State University, a beekeeper, and a wonderful resource for a good book to read. She lives in Providence. Thank you for joining us on this edition of The Zesty Garden. We'll be back next Thursday. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. The Be Well Moment is made possible by the USU Department of Human Resources Wellness Program at usu.edu/HR.
October is National Depression Awareness Month. Depression is a common but serious illness. Do not be ashamed if you believe or feel that you may have depression. Here are some useful tips when dealing with common symptoms. Get a depression screening done if you are feeling down. It is better to get checked than to sit and wait. The sooner you seek treatment, the better your outlook will be. Treat problems such as insomnia or sleep apnea to help ease your symptoms. Eat healthy. A good diet rich in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and fish may help battle depression. Learn to walk away. Depression can cloud your judgment. Try taking a deep breath and make decisions about a topic when you begin to feel better. Remember, depression does not have to be a normal part of life. With the right steps and a positive attitude, you can overcome it. This is Nicole Jackson for the Be Well program at Utah State University. Be well, Utah.